Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, a.k.a. Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy, high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking with Randolph Wicker, he's the founder of the Clone Rights United Front and director and spokesperson of the Human Cloning Foundation. Welcome, Randolph.
My pleasure to be here.
Now, I have long expected to find what I now discover has been in existence for several years, your organization, because it seems like the technologies that the Luddites, the bio-Luddites are so concerned about, cloning, stem cells, and so forth, have so many great potentials that folks are beginning to get mobilized around defending those potentials and defending our right to them. Is that what led you to this cause?
Well, actually, we predate the stem cell discovery. We were a very tiny movement, started back when the announcement of Dolly's birth came. And I found that I have a little bit of insomnia. I'd turn on the TV in the middle of the night, and they would be having so-called debates in which one person, suit and tie with a doctor or a title like that, would be saying, we must see that this is never even tried in human beings. The other person, who I guess was supposed to be the liberal or the pro-cloning person, would say, well, shouldn't we see what the, what the options are, what the implications are before we just blanketly outlaw, cloning of human beings? And I thought, what a weak defense. I mean, where's someone saying it's my reproductive right to reproduce in the manner that I see fit? If I want a later born twin, I have the right to that. So a little tin horn politician here in New York named Markey made news, national news, by introducing a bill in the New York State legislature which would have made cloning a human being a felony punishable by 4 to 7 years in jail. And I just was livid. I mean, here was this guy. What did he know about cloning? He was just a Staten Island Republican looking to up his credentials, probably with the right wing of his party, upstate. It was just, to me, a cheap political shot. And yet here it ends up being a big news story in the New York Times. And that's the point that I decided I'm going to get involved in this debate. So we went down and registered the names, and I gathered a group of friends. A lot of them were just old friends that had, were there in support of me as much as in support of cloning, and a couple new volunteers who had come by because we had put up signs around the village. And we had the first pro-human cloning demonstration in Sheridan Square within that Saturday night, less than a week after the announcement of Dolly's birth. Then what happened was that I managed to go down and talk at NIBAC and protest their recommendations that cloning be banned for 5 years. And there were virtually no people speaking in opposition. And it was a very, very tiny movement. Like some people saw especially infertile people that were infertile, I found was really one of the major constituencies for the cloning message. But then in November of 1998, they discovered human stem cells. And this put everything on its ear, because human stem cells, people are only now beginning to make the connection, but human stem cells are the basic cells of all life. They can differentiate in any cell of your body. So let's say that you had heart trouble. If we could take stem cells that came from you and make them diversify into heart cells, which they can do now with my stem cells, and put them in, inject them into your body, those cells will find their way to your heart and repair your heart. So the promise, suddenly we were like this tiny movement. You talk about wind beneath your wings. We had like a hurricane beneath either wing. Suddenly, because the technology of the two were identical. In other words, the way I would be able to get a stem cell culture that was compatible with you, that your body would not reject whatever kind of differentiated cell we could create from that stem cell culture, we'd have to take one of your cells, put it in a denucleated egg, and have it start dividing. To create a stem cell culture, before that got to be 18 cells, we'd have to chop it up and turn it into a stem cell culture. In other words, not allow it to continue developing and start differentiating. If we continue to allow it to develop and start differentiating it and then put it in a woman's womb, then we would have your later born twin on the way. I don't like the term clone. because I think clone is a, it, like all debates, language has a lot to do with it. Clone to me is a dehumanizing term. Mm-hmm. I prefer the term either later born twin or child conceived through cloning.
Well, that's an interesting point, because a lot of the bioethicists that I know who are skittish about publicly defending cloning to the extent that you and I would, will privately say that this is an absolute non-issue, because, yes, there have been millennia of cultures who have been disturbed by the concept of twins, but, you know, we don't have to be one of them. We don't have to be one of those cultures that decides that any twin should be set out on a rock and, you know, smashed to death, and that it's a non-issue.
Right. As far as I am, as far as I'm concerned, it certainly is, you know, and the second aspect, I mean, you get into the reproductive freedom aspect there, in that, in the sense that if you feel that, you know, you want to reproduce in this manner, and it could be a regular couple. As a matter of fact, I had a woman in here that she had four generations of lupus on her side, and her daughter had decided not to have children because she didn't want to deal with another child with lupus. You know, so you may have a very bad genetic background in a traditional couple that would be fertile, but they may choose to try to avoid the genetic background, you know, of the one partner by literally cloning the other partner. One of the small groups that I find to be very passionate on this subject are single women who have never met a man they fit to be parent of their child. And this was dramatically brought home for me by a woman that called from Texas, who had been going from fertility clinic to fertility clinic, saying, "Look, I'd like to have, you know, be helped to have a child." And of course, they'd love to see you come in a fertility clinic, because here comes $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, maybe $100,000 if they try many, many times, mm-hmm. and they have a very ultimately have a relatively low rate of success. But then she would say, "I want to be cloned," and the reason she wanted to be cloned was that she had an identical sister. And she said, "The relationship I have with my sister cannot be compared to any relationship I've ever had with any other human being in my entire life."
That's one of the great ironies, isn't it, that we often valorize the relationship that twins have and the close understanding and intimacy that they have, but somehow if you make a clone, it's considered a violation of human dignity and going to somehow devalorize that relationship.
Right, and people don't even realize that it's a twin. You know, I mean, we have to keep reminding them that cloning is not unnatural, because cloning occurs naturally in nature every time a pair of identical twins are born. You know, and all a child conceived through cloning would be is a later-born twin. I mean, I could imagine. I mean, you start thinking of familial implications here. I can imagine situations where parents had a child, and the child was 3 or 4 or 5 years old, and they thought this child was just the most wonderful thing that had ever happened in their life, which a lot of parents feel that, you know, maybe it was a very gifted child, whatever. They may decide, instead of having a random collision of sperm and egg and taking whatever comes down the pike, that they might want to clone their 5-year-old child and have a later born twin of her. So you would have twins raised in the same family that would only be, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 years apart in age.
Mm-hmm. Now, people are worried about the effect that this would have on family relationships, that there would be some kind of confusion about whether this is my child or my slave or whatever. But it would really fit in quite naturally into current parent-child relationships, don't you think?
Well, I think that there's some validity to some of the there are intelligent objections that we really don't know the answers to. For instance, the couple that I mentioned maybe has a bad genetic background on one side. They clone the one parent. Would the parent who was cloned have a much closer relationship with that child than the other parent? In other words, would there be such a special bond between either the mother and the daughter or the father and the son that it would somehow overshadow or complicate or become, you know, disruptive to the relationship, maybe even between the, you know, the triangle or the multiple things that make a family? Or the other question you might have is, would a child that was conceived through cloning have such a special relationship that with the one parent that it would be disruptive to the interrelationships that or the relationships the parents had with other siblings if it was a family in which there were other children? But I have always taken the position, let's deal with these problems if and when they arise. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have, we live in a world, you know, people say, it's unnatural or it's dangerous. Well, you know, the year before Frank Lloyd Wright flew, there are people that would tell you that if God had meant man to fly, they would have given him wings. And anybody who was an ethical person, any ethical committee, would, if you applied for a permit to try to fly, they would have said, we cannot allow you to try to fly because look at all the people who have died trying to fly. Because up to that time, you know, there had been hundreds of people that had died attempting to fly. So, you know, I think that there's so much held back. If you really start reading in the history of science, it's very depressing. An example would be IVF, which was possible in the early 40s. In 1979, you know, literally 30, 40 years later, they were setting up a study in Virginia to see if it was feasible to try it. And why was this? Because people were screaming about test tube babies. Moralists were saying, you know, babies should not be conceived in test tubes. But then Louise Brown was born. And once they saw this was just a normal child, the parents were just normal parents that wanted a child, and they described people peeking into the baby carriage to see if Louise Brown had two heads and looked like a Martian or something, right? So that answered the problem. The same thing's going to happen, in my opinion, with children conceived through cloning, and that is that it's going to be very interesting because I really don't envy the first half a dozen or dozen children conceived in this fashion. Because, you know, with Dolly the sheep, here's an amazing thing. An adult sheep has been cloned, you know, adult cell has been reprogrammed into a sheep. But what's interesting about a sheep? You look at a sheep, how long can you be interested? One of the scientists testifying at the New York Senate Investigation Subcommittee hearing, where I also testified, said, we don't even know if Dolly is mentally retarded, because who knows? All sheep are mentally retarded. Of course, everyone laughed. We actually know Dolly seems to be a completely normal sheep. She's learned to go over and beg for candy, and she does all sorts of things like a spoiled sheep would do.
You said you would. You may not envy.
Well, yeah, because what's going to happen? People are going to be utterly fascinated. Someone said, I mean, their doctors now trying to raise money to start clinics to clone human beings, and someone said to me, "Well, Randy, why aren't you right there with the first?" I said, because, you know, I value my privacy. I don't want to live a life in which, you know, I couldn't even go to a bathroom without coming out and having three video cameras sitting in my face. Because they're going to be following these people microscopically. They're going to be saying, well, Daddy walked at, you know, age 1.5 or talked at 2. You know, any differences, any similarities, the public is going to be utterly mesmerized by the similarities and differences between what I call the originator or the older twin and the later born twin.
You're listening to Randy Wicker, founder of the Clone Rights United Front, discuss our rights to human cloning on Change Surfer Radio.
You said that you didn't think that you would envy them, but there may be one very good reason that we'll envy clones, and that's because the technology has changed since Dolly. Dolly was discovered to have these shorter telomeres, so that she
Well, no, that is propaganda.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Tell me.
What the story on that is, the scientist wrote a letter to Nature magazine saying that it seemed to them that Dolly had shorter telomeres, and then it turned out that these telomeres were 20% or 25% shorter than they thought they should be. And I can tell you, when I testified to the U.S. Senate, the Frist Committee, they had the Frist bill that would outlaw cloning nationally. I was one of the 18 expert witnesses that testified. Everyone else was saying, we're against human cloning, but please don't pass this bill. It would restrict research into, you know, other things. This was back in February of 1998.
Right.
And the guys there on the representatives were saying, are we sure that this has occurred? How do we know that Dolly is in a mammoth fraud? And what I tell people is that the mentality is first is that you don't want to deal with this subject. And then suddenly there is Dolly standing there. I mean, the best thing next to not having her there is wishing her dead or wishing her prematurely dead. Since that story broke, the other little nuances were they weren't sure whether a 20 or 25% variation in telomeres were within the range of normality, because the telomeres are so difficult and so tiny that they are very hard to study. And since that, as a matter of fact, a total antidote to that story, which of course the media didn't pick up on, is that they cloned some, I think, calves recently, and the calves had much longer telomeres.
Right.
Advanced, than normal.
Advanced cell technology, folks. Yeah.
Right, which might indicate that that cloning, instead of being born, or they would like you to believe that Dolly might have been 6 or 7 years old when she was born, that maybe a cloned animal with longer telomeres will live longer. I think a lot of this comes down to the politics behind the judgments of the people that are putting out the information. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We have a thing, don't be at www.humancloning.org. We have a line saying, don't be fooled by the telomere scare.
Oh, good.
Which I think has a lot of this detail in it.
Yes, yeah. Well, I found you there, actually, www.humancloning.org.
Right.
So I recommend that people go there. Now, you also have on that website that you've had sign-on from various bioethicists and public dignitaries. Greg Pence, who's written a defense of human cloning.
Right, and he's also written an amazingly broad-based book called Recreating Medicine, in which he goes into everything from cloning and what he calls assisted reproduction, and gives you very good history of medicine in general, to things like organ donation. He's for a system where the state would have a death benefit. In other words, if you were an organ donor and you were to die in a car accident, you would receive, if you want to donate organs, you would receive a death benefit. But then the state would decide who would get the organs. In other words, the organs would be by a panel that decided who was most in need of them. It wouldn't be like we're auctioning off body parts.
Right.
They did this in Spain, and Spain used to have the lowest number of donated organs in all of Europe. And after they put this program into effect in Spain, Spain became one of the most organ donor rich countries in Europe. They proposed this exact thing in Pennsylvania, but it languishes in the House because, you get into this whole argument, oh, what are you doing? You're starting to, buy and sell human body parts.
Well, the issue that you're raising is that I think with a lot of these bioethical questions, biopolitical questions, we're facing a growing divide in our country between folks like ourselves, who are sometimes referred to as transhumanists, and the kind of biofundamentalists, the folks who don't want to deal with medical technology, wish that it would just go away, would like to ban it if they could, the Luddites.
Well, a lot of them, but I think the best definition of bioethicists I ever heard are professional worriers. I mean, their job is to sit around and try to fret and worry and raise every possible problem that you could invent. You know what I mean?
Which applies to consumer advocates often as well.
Right, and I tell people, someone say, well, this technology could be abused. Well, yes, automobiles kill more people in America than almost anything else, but no one is advocating the banning of automobiles. Every technology, you could get intoxicated, get out behind the wheel of your car and go kill somebody, but that doesn't mean we should outlaw cars. So I really think that to blanketly, but I agree with you on the fundamentalistic, this also falls over into the genetically engineered food debate.
Right. But a lot of hysteria involved, very little science.
Right. I mean, and if you really follow, by the way, I might mention a very, very good resource to people, Reason Magazine, www.reason.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they have excellent articles. One's called Petri Dish Politics from their December issue of December 99. There's an incredible one called Billions Saved, I think, in just a recent issue. They're all done by a science editor by the name of Ronald Bailey, Bailey.
Yeah.
He also interviewed Lee Silver in April of 1998, and Lee Silver pointed out then, which we're seeing more and more now in these biotech stories, that drugs are not going to be made in factories anymore. Drugs are going to be grown on farms, because what they're doing now is they're genetically engineering animals that produce medicines in their milk at a much greater quantity than they can produce them, in laboratories with yeast cultures and everything.
Right. Well, now, the libertarians have been defending technology against Luddism for a long time, but I was recently impressed when I saw the National Academy of Sciences, which had joined in a study of biotech food issues with 7 other National Academies of Science from other countries, including some third world countries, and they've put up a website at the nationalacademies.org site on biotech food, which has a very balanced set of reports.
Right.
And they basically argue that with appropriate regulation, you know, this is one of the things that libertarians wouldn't talk about.
Right.
But with appropriate regulation, appropriate assurances of efficacy and so forth, and supports for third world farmers, that this could really be a boon to production of food worldwide.
It isn't a question of a boon. It's an absolute necessity.
Yeah.
If you read this article, A Billion Saved in Reason Magazine. A matter of fact, I think I have it right here. The guy that they interviewed is a Nobel won a Nobel Prize in 1970 for creating the rice, the miracle rice that literally staved off the coming. You know, the idea that the world was here is billions served. It's called Reason Magazine, April 2000, and it was an interview. With the man, agronomist Norman Borlaug, L-A-U-G, who won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. And he still teaches at age 86 at Texas A&M. And what he points out in here, if we did as Prince Charles would have us do and raise all our food organically, there wouldn't be a tree left standing. I mean, we would have to clear all the forest. We'd have no woodland, no prairie, because you'd have to not only use all the land we use today, you'd have to go out and use all the other viable land and even go up on the hillsides and tear down forests. But it's only been through the great increases in food production per acre that we've been able to keep the world from starving to death. India has become self-sufficient.
More realistically, it'd probably be a formula for mass starvation.
Right, and he makes a point. Well, you know, we seize on these things because I was upset about the monarch butterfly story.
Right.
And he said that it was the biggest bunch of hooey. And he said, first of all, the pollen, the corn pollen's only there for a short period of time. In other words, butterflies go there all the time, so there'd only be a limited number exposed to the corn pollen. They found out that if you put out like 10 rows of regular corn between the acres of the, genetically engineered corn, that would eliminate the effect on a monarch butterfly. And he's the one that points out that the real hope for saving the world or saving billions of people that are living on a dollar a day, if they can put a carrot gene in rice, they can improve nutrition such that it'll keep hundreds of thousands of people from dying of diseases rooted in malnutrition. But yet we're dealing with this fundamentalism. When you talk about in cloning is very much related to religious, like Roman Catholic theology that believes that once a cell divides, once a human life is on the way, even if this is just an embryo that's no bigger than a pencil dot on your paper.
We just have a couple more minutes, but I wanted to follow that point up because two of the things that you've addressed in your public advocacy, one is that a lot of the opposition to this research and to stem cells in particular has been from Right to Life organizations.
That's right.
On the basis of their opposition to any use of embryos in medical research,
right.
which fortunately, because of the culturing and cloning in petri dishes of stem cells, we may be able to get away from. But in any case, the embryonic issue is out there. The other is the very interesting issue of the use of these technologies by non-traditional families like gay and lesbian couples to have children, which a lot of fundamentalists and religious folks have been opposed to.
Well, that's true. Also, when I'm on the radio, they also very much object to single. In other words, goodness, a woman
right.
could choose to clone herself
without
and be
a
single parent. They don't think that children should be born to single parents.
Without the holy union.
Right, right. And, you know, we have members that I consider Right to Life in the cloning debate. Shauna Cuddle, who is featured on our website, very interested in growing kidneys or, you know, dealing with kidney failure through stem cell, cloning technology, couldn't imagine having an abortion. I think that the abortion debate could just be moved to the point where a cell connects to the edge of a womb. I mean, an embryo that's created in a Petri dish to be chopped up and to create a stem cell culture to treat a fatal disease in someone, I do not see how anyone in a rational or reasonable mind could forbid that on the grounds that this 18 little cell cluster is a human being.
Especially if it's going to keep someone alive for another 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, Randy, I'm really delighted to discover your organization. I have a link from my website, the changesurfer.com website, to the humancloning.org website.
I wish I hadn't gotten off on the genetic food trips so much. But let me give you www.humancloning.org again.
Yeah.
As a website.
And can people give you a phone call or email? Why don't you give us your email address?
My email address is rwicker@gateway.net. If you forget that, you can email me through the Human Cloning Foundation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think if you send it there, it'll be forwarded to me also.
Good.
And I do have a... we're looking for infertile couples who want to talk to media, and that's what I really want to talk about. We desperately need people who want to reproduce through cloning, and what we keep getting are couples that they're not willing to go public about being infertile. It's the biggest closet in America is the infertile the infertile couple closet.
Have you had any contact with Richard Seed, who's also...
Oh, I know Richard Seed. We were on a panel together. Matter of fact, he's a right to life. Well, I didn't mention him. He would have been second on the list.
I didn't know he was right to life.
He does not insist on being introduced as a devout Methodist, devout Christian, does not believe in abortion after the 30th day. See, this right to life thing, it depends on where you draw the line. The real fundamentalists begin with a two-cell division. Richard Seed says not after the third month. There are people like even Moynihan, Senator Moynihan here in New York, was mentioned in some article I was reading, saying that he considered partial birth abortion infanticide, even though he is... has a very good pro-choice record. So I think everyone basically sort of decides for themselves on a long continuum. I think very few people have any objection up to the third, the third month, the first trimester, before there's any brain cell or any brain stem or anything like that there. But once you get beyond that, it becomes increasingly difficult.
I'm finding it hard to get offline with you because you raised the issue in my mind of extrauterine gestation, which I have argued that once we actually start to decant fetuses into artificial wombs and start raising them, that we'll be able to treat them with a much more graduated set of rights, graduated to their neurological status. And
Lee Silver rather knocks that idea. He says he's the one that wrote the greatest book of the 20th century, Remaking Eden, and is very much pro human cloning. His idea to totally frame the debate. He says the creation of the human of an artificial womb is very, very far off because the interaction between the growing fetus and the mother, there are so many nuances in chemical and nutritional interactions. It's not something in his opinion that's going to be feasible in any reasonable foreseeable future.
I suspect that may be true, although we may use it as an emergency stopgap measure despite its risks.
Well, we also were able to test embryos, choose which embryo to put into. I mean, there are a lot of things related that I didn't want to attack your... I believe in letting dreamers dream. I didn't want to knock down one of your dreams.
Well, I think it would be a great benefit to some women if they didn't have to carry it around for 9 months.
Well, they have it today. It's called surrogate mothers.
That's right.
You hire them and they do the job for you.
If you can afford it.
You can afford it, and if you don't get trapped, as a couple I just were dealing with, in which the surrogate mother decided to keep the baby after they'd paid all the medical bills.
Right.
In some states, they have the right to do that.
That's right. Well, fascinating talking to you, Randy, and I wish you the best of luck, and I hope to have you back sometime.
Anytime.
I've been talking with Randolph Wicker. He's the founder of New York's Clone Rights United Front, and he's director and spokesperson of the Human Cloning Foundation. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.